Shrink Wrap Radio number 487, Star Wars Psychology, or Dark Side of the Mind, with Dr. Travis Langley.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Travis Langley, a psychology professor at Henderson State University, where he teaches courses on crime, social behavior, mental illness, and media, including courses titled Batman and Psych of the Living Dead. For more information about Dr. Travis Langley, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Eyeglasses cost too much. Now you can save by ordering online from Warby Parker. More about this special offer later in our podcast. Before we go to the interview, our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, is putting on a year-long online certification course in West African divination and counseling with Maladoma Somme, whom I interviewed on episode number 444. For information and sign up, go to jungplatform.com/courses. Dr. Travis Langley, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm pleased to have you on the show. You're having a very interesting career, it seems. You've written or edited several books on mass culture phenomena such as zombies and Batman and now Star Wars. What's drawn you to this sort of thing?
Well, once upon a time, I was born a nerdy child.
Okay.
I've always been, you know, interested in heroism and stories. I mean, throughout the history of the world, people have always been into these things. But
sure.
Me in particular, it's hard to say. You know, I grew up on television and comic books, you know, science fiction. These were always intriguing to me, what they say about where we're going, where we've been, what people are like. You know, I sometimes felt like an alien among the human species.
Oh, okay. That might explain something. Do you think that these films and comics have something deeper to say to us?
Oh, yes. I don't think they would be that popular if they didn't. You know, the scale of these things, what's going on, particularly science fiction and fantasy, I really think there are many ways in which we can look more frankly at real truths than with some things that are a little closer to home. You know, in Star Wars, for example, you know, the cantina scene where they go into the bar and the bartender points at the droids and says, "We don't serve their kind."
Yeah.
You know, because he's surrounded by aliens about whom we don't have predispositions. We don't have existing biases. Like if he were surrounded by groups from the real world, we can immediately see the irony and hypocrisy of the whole thing, where dealing strictly with real groups, we would have our biases perhaps get in the way. The science fiction, fantasy, all the speculative fiction has to be truer to real human nature because of the fantastic situations. You know, with more down-to-earth fiction, oddly enough, you don't have to be quite as true to real human reactions because we don't already have something that's pushing the limits of suspension of disbelief.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned Star Wars, and that's going to be out in a week or so. So let's focus on that a bit. Your latest book, in fact, is titled Star Wars Psychology, Dark Side of the Mind. What are you getting at with that title? Yes.
Well, actually, I wanted to call it Star Wars Psychology Jedi Mind Tricks. But Jedi is a trademarked word, and to justify using that one, you would have to have had the entire book be about the Jedi, and it's not. There are plenty of sections about the Jedi and the Sith, but we talked about the droids and the non-Jedi characters, Han and Leia and Lando and others. And so it's not just about that. But even the dark side of the mind part, that was actually my editor's suggestion after we couldn't do Jedi mind tricks, which I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And she suggested that. My first thought was, that seems a bit negative, but I discussed it with some of the writers who were contributing chapters. And we decided among ourselves, well, if we look at it from the Jungian sense, which is we're not all Jungians, but from looking at Star Wars, well, that is relevant because Jung directly shaped Star Wars through Joseph Campbell. I guess that's indirectly. we said, because the dark side of the mind is not the evil side. It is the unexplored. It's the part that's not out in the light. You know, it can be your best qualities as well. This is the parts that have not been explored. And we look at it from that sense, it's like, okay, yes, actually, dark side of the mind works like that, even if I will repeatedly have to explain the subtitle.
Yeah, because that's the thing that I wrestled with, and so I wondered, well, what about courage, purpose, friendship, hunger for adventure, spiritual aspirations, and so on? And of course, those are all in there too, as you suggest.
And for plenty of people, those things are in the dark side of their own nature. Someone who has courage, Han Solo, who says he will never stick his neck out for anybody. His better qualities are suppressed. Some of it's been a survival mechanism in the rough area that he's lived in. You know, he's got courage. He's got altruism. He's got the willingness to stick up and be a hero, but it's been suppressed. It's hidden in his own dark side, and it gets brought out into the light. You know, in Star Wars itself, A New Hope, as it became after 4 years, you know, he shows up at the end to cover Luke's back, and the next movie starts with him rushing out into the snow, willing to die to make sure his friend is safe. So these qualities have come from being hidden within himself out into the light. I really think one of the strongest messages in the Star Wars films is to look beyond the surface, that everyone has layers. Everyone has other things going on within themselves. You know, Han Solo, just like that. Princess Leia, who looks like the damsel in distress, but she's already a hero. She has to take over her own rescue because those guys don't know what they're doing. You know, Chewbacca, who's presented as this monster who supposedly rips out arms, never does. We discover he's one of the most nurturing characters. When C-3PO is missing, who goes looking for him? Chewbacca. Who puts them back together, even if the head is on backwards? Chewbacca. Who are the deadliest killers? The teddy bears. You know, as we go through these, we see again and again this message, and in the end, Luke wins the day because he has faith that beyond Darth Vader's obvious darkness, that there is light within him, that deep in that darkness there is more light, there is a better side to his nature. You know, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, he has given up. He says, well, the Emperor's already won if you're not going to kill Vader. You know, he doesn't see that there's something else going on in there. But Luke does, because he looks past the surface.
Yeah, and we've got a new Star Wars franchise coming out now, our new film. I guess in a couple of weeks, do you know what the release date is?
18th. Okay. Friday. We've got it. It's almost here. Okay. And for those of us who saw Return of the Jedi in 1983, we've been waiting for this one for a really long time.
Yeah, in fact, I read just this morning that people have been lined up for 2 weeks. I can't believe it. That's amazing. And that there is a website called liningup.net in which people can sign up to stand in line and and to reserve, to have have reserved seats. So what a phenomenon. And I'm glad that it's being revived, because unlike you and me, who kind of grew up with this, with a series of films and made a big impact on both of us, I taught a class up until I retired 10 years ago called Myth, Dream, and Symbol, and I was often referring to Star Wars, and many of my students had not seen any of them. So it's good that our conversation here and the others that you're having in interviews that you're doing and this new film is going to revive interest and hopefully bring a whole new generation of people into this mythology.
Yeah, you think Star Wars, the most successful movie in the world for a long time. Everyone will know this. No.
Yeah, right.
There is no one story. There is no one specific detail that you can assume everyone knows. So you have to approach it carefully. The ones that are better known, you can assume more of the room will, but you still have to keep in mind not everybody will. In my personality class, when I get to the Jung part and talk about archetypes.
Yeah.
It is easy to use examples from Star Wars because George Lucas deliberately wove Jungian archetypes into the story. And I was talking about this one time, and there was a student who asked, who's George Lucas? And there was two things hit me. One, okay, this is cultural literacy. But the other thing was, I just said who he was, so what are you asking?
Oh, you're bringing back the good old days of teaching here. Yeah. You know, I actually, when I discovered Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, I thought, wow, this is amazing, you know, that there's this stuff in the movie. And I thought that George Lucas had just sort of accidentally, you know, put in all these perfect things. And then only later did I discover, no, he actually, you know, was drawing on Hero with a Thousand Faces and maybe even had conversations with Campbell. I don't know.
He did. They got to be friends.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You
know, I mean, obviously, there are many influences, Kurosawa films, cowboy movies. And in fact, I dedicate the book Star Wars Psychology to my grandfathers with a note that, okay, science fiction was not exactly their thing, but there's a lot of cowboy movie in that first Star Wars film.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the one grandfather I still have, it's nice to dedicate one while I still have grandfathers. He said he might finally watch Star Wars because of that dedication.
Oh boy, oh boy, yeah. I hope you get to watch it with him, and that'll be a real bonding experience. You know, your publicist sent me a flyer, and one of the things I noted that point that it made there was how Jedi practices are used in psychotherapy. So. We have many psychotherapists who listen to this series, so please enlighten us.
Well, of course, you know, I'm not the therapist. I'm a psychology professor. You know, I decided long ago I didn't want to do that therapy stuff.
Okay.
You know, I want to go in the ivory tower. I had been a child abuse investigator and saw some of the worst of things and, you know, didn't want to do that. I liked talking. I liked teaching. But you know, I do have therapists who've contributed chapters to these things, you know, how they'll talk about principles such as discipline and finding your inner peace and, you know, the way of the Jedi and how that has practical applications in terms of reflecting on yourself. Now, of course, we can also look at, you know, the way of the Jedi and look at how, well, as a business model, it didn't work very well because they all fell apart, you know, in episode 3.
Huh.
But that's a different perspective, you know, in terms of looking at yourself and looking at your own life. You know, there is a lot of value in these steps. Some of the reasons that George Lucas is so popular is he didn't just, you know, weave in these archetypes so deliberately and pull in all these other influences. You know, he also touched on something that's very meaningful to individuals spiritually, even individuals who don't think of themselves as being spiritual. You know, you can have an atheist, you can have a very religious person, but they still have a sense of deeper meaning that there's something else going on. And Star Wars, fiction that it is, can help people reflect on what does this feel like?
Yeah.
Even if it's not what it means, even if you don't see it as being the force of Star Wars, the feeling of it resonates with people.
I think you're so right. And just that idea of the force. And, you know, Luke, tune into the force, that there's something that's permeating the universe that you can't see, but that you can tap into and that can bring you strength and wisdom and so on. And somehow that seems to almost coincide with something that's happened, at least in a large subset of our culture. A sense of spirituality while traditional religion is being abandoned. So many people will describe themselves as spiritual but not religious.
There have been a growing number of those. And my father, a Methodist minister, and I, you know, we've had a number of conversations about what it is that's moving people away. You know, this age of technology, this age of instant information, where you keep hearing about, you know, this person or that person, where they have failed us. And it can be difficult for someone, you know, who sees it, whether it's Westboro Baptist Church, there's an extreme, you know, or, you know, the minister who's been caught being human, you know, making very human mistakes. And for some of them, it can be, you know, difficult when they're hearing this information. And it's the negative stuff that gets thrown out there. The, you know, good news, you know, doesn't get the attention the same way. You know, in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. And they will promote the worst of human nature so many ways. And this age of 24/7 internet and cable, and we're being inundated with these things. And of course, those themselves are distractions. It's like, well, I go to church Sunday morning and I can be on Facebook. And you know, that's happening with a lot of people, and it's going on in discussions in churches all around. It's like, what does it take to appeal? You know, what does it take to interest people? It's like, you know, be upfront. Don't change your beliefs to accommodate them. But what does it take to, you know, resonate with the newer generation? And that takes some thinking.
Yeah, and you're talking about technology, and of course there is a lot of technology in Star Wars, so we could talk about that a little bit. One of the things you've pointed out, that we tend to dehumanize the stormtroopers, but we care about the machines like D2 and R2. And
well, it depends on which machines.
Yeah.
Depends on which machines. The battle droids, they're dehumanized like the stormtroopers.
Yeah, yeah. So talk a little bit about that dynamic, because, for example, you know, I'm kind of in love with my iPhone and Siri, so.
I curse Siri.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. She doesn't know what I'm saying. And then she doesn't like me griping at her. I really think Siri is going to be the first, the opening advance attack from Skynet when the tide comes. Siri will just steer everybody into the wrong lane of traffic and wipe out half the population real fast before Skynet does the rest of its stuff. I'm exaggerating slightly.
Yeah, I hope so. There's kind of an ambivalence about technology in the film, I'm realizing, because here's Han Solo. His rocket ship is very clunky in some ways, you know. He can't rely on it. It doesn't always kick into its super drive, you know, when he wants it to. He has to bang on things and so on and talk to it. And that's the experience that many of us have with our technology, right?
There is a bit of distrust of technology throughout Star Wars for all this tech that they're using. You know, why aren't they showing even greater advances? Why does it seem like, from what we gather, they're using a lot of the same technology they were using centuries earlier? There's some kind of distrust of the technology that's even keeping them from making advances, and then that reflects in how they treat the mechanical entities, these droids, who are clearly sentient entities. They are self-aware. They have emotions. But most of them are treated as property, as things. Mm-hmm. You know,
they're slaves, in a sense, then.
Yeah.
Which raises that whole question about where AI and robotics might take us, and then how will we regard those entities, which is now being explored in the cartoon strip Dilbert, very interestingly. I don't know if you read Dilbert.
I haven't lately. I wait till it gets a collection, and then I catch up.
Oh, well, it's a nice path that he's going down now with a sentient robot, and so you've got something to look forward to there.
So he goes through, he has the dinosaur that he found behind the couch, and he has a robot. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see here.
Well, actually, I kind of got sidetracked from your original question about the way they're treating these, the difference between how they treat the droids and the stormtroopers.
Okay,
go with that. The droids that we care about, they have, besides their individual differences in personality and names that we can remember, it's like R2-D2 being much shorter than the long code that they'll give some stormtrooper. You know, the mix of letters and numbers makes it more memorable than the code that they'll give a stormtrooper. But they have individual differences in appearance, where you'll have another droid that looks like it's from the same mold as C-3PO. It's still a different color. And throughout the ones that we care about as individuals, they've got variety in colors and appearance. The battle droids all look the same. stormtroopers all look the same. If stormtroopers were coming along, each wearing their own individual bling, you know, and coloring it up with different markings, if they individualized, we would be conscious of them as individuals. But we're not. They all come from the same mold. They might as well be machines as most of us perceive them. It is very clear that Episode 7, as they're not calling The Force Awakens, is going to get into some of that. We are going to see the fact that these stormtroopers are individuals.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's interesting, because you're right. They're sort of just almost like a single bland entity in a way, and it reminds me of Sam Keen's book, Faces of the Enemy, and the way that propagandists will paint a picture of the enemy that's very very uniform. So that individuality is not there to evoke our human.
The out-group homogeneity.
Exactly.
You know, in-group differentiation, you distinguish among those that you're in the in-group that are the group you're in.
Yeah.
And so the characters we're supposed to identify with, they are visually differentiated, so we can immediately feel like they're the in-group. The ones that are presented all the same, we're ready to see them as being the out-group, the group we're not connected to, because of that tendency for out-group homogeneity to see members of the group we're not in as all being the same anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And it's another thing that's interesting is the kind of conflict that's going on in the world today that goes back centuries and centuries, the major clash, you know, between these two civilizations that's happening in our own time and that is escalating and spinning out of control. And that's sort of what's depicted in Star Wars, you know? And when it first came out, it might have seemed a little bit more far-fetched. And now it even rings with more immediacy, I think.
Well, I'm not sure about it seeming far-fetched, because it was still drawing on, you know, fears that had come out of World War II. You know, very clearly they modeled some things after the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the goose-stepping march. Not quite goose-step, but it's made to sound like it.
Yeah.
And the style of the uniforms, they are evoking, you know, a sense of the Nazi regime and the Nazi soldiers, and how easy it is for people, you know, to watch, you know, war movies where the enemies were the Nazis, even though those individual soldiers were guys with families who were doing the job that the government was sending them to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's because of the way the Nazis depersonalized, de-individualized their own soldiers. And from a military point of view, that makes some sense. That also makes it easier for the, you know, people on the other side to see them as all being the same, even though the Americans are all wearing the same uniforms, but we get to know them and individuate them in other ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What about the music? I gather that you think that the score plays an important part.
What's interesting is almost every interviewer comments about that music chapter. We've got these 20 chapters, but one of the last ones by Jim Davies, and Jim Davies, psychologist, but his co-author is a film music composer, has done music for films like Mission Impossible 5, and they're looking at the psychological effects of the music, how this particular change in tempo, or from the higher pitch to the lower pitch, or the reverse, resonates in our nervous system to relate to how moods feel. And John Williams, a man with a gift, you know, both cognitively and emotionally, able to pull together what will resonate with human beings, what will make us feel these things. You know, Williams, who also has this gift for having music, they'll even make you think of lyrics. You know, there's a particular lyric, so it just seems like, if you've ever seen the old skit on Saturday Night Live, well, Bill Murray's doing the lounge singer who puts words to lyrics. Some of what he's doing feels like we go, Star Wars, you know, no nearer or far wars, okay, but the star, it feels like it's saying Star Wars over and over with Williams. Superman theme. There's part that actually outright feels like this. This sounds like the songs, the music says Superman, and he evokes these things to make us feel these ourselves. Sometimes it's very conscious, sometimes it's very subtle.
You know, I just realized that I have a little Star Wars figure that I keep on my printer here. It's Jar Jar Biggs.
Why do you have Jar Jar Binks on your printer?
I liked Jar Jar, and I guess I was in the minority, but I just got a big kick out of Jar Jar Binks. Talk to us about Jar Jar, his plus, his minus.
Well, if you like Jar Jar, that's fine. I didn't care for Jar Jar. I do think people overreacted a bit to Jar Jar, gave him more attention than he deserved. But
I understand that he plays a major role in this new film that's coming out.
I think that's just a rumor. Abrams and others have said no, he does not.
Oh, too bad. I was ready rise of Jar Jar.
The Bink Strikes Back.
Yeah, right.
It's one thing I did comment about Jar Jar. There's this personality factor of agreeableness that, you know, has many different qualities. Mm-hmm. The interest in getting along with others, and sometimes the tendency to agree for the sake of getting along, and a need to be liked. Some professionals will use likability as a synonym for it. And in my little feature on that, my main examples were Lando Calrissian and Jar Jar. You know, Lando Calrissian, who goes to great efforts to get along with the Empire, to get along with the Rebels, just repeatedly, who can I get along with now? And he has this charm to him, and many people find him likable. But Jar Jar Binks, who also is very motivated to get along and do things with people and support, obviously, he's not universally likable, so likability is not exactly a great synonym for agreeableness. Huh. Some individuals like him. Some individuals don't like him.
You're making me feel uncomfortable here because I'm realizing that I'm kind of a people pleaser, and maybe that's what I like about Jar Jar. Hey, he's one of my people.
But, you know, agreeableness is useful. It is a valuable thing. You know, people who are leaders are more agreeable than disagreeable, but they're not at the extreme. People who are at the extremes of agreeability or agreeableness, depending on which version of it you're reading, the people who are the extremes of being agreeable without bringing some disagreeableness to them, they don't make good leaders. They can make really good followers, but the strong leader needs to have some disagreeableness, needs to have times when he's willing to rub people the wrong way for the sake of getting other things done. So it needs to be more agreeable than not, but not completely agreeable. It depends on what you are trying to do, you know, what you're wanting to achieve. The people pleaser, you know, is able to accomplish certain things better than many other individuals, but that can't be the main thing you want to do. That can't be your top priority. You know, Jar Jar, for his need to be a people pleaser, also advances a really terrible motion in episode 2 that causes horrible things to happen. It's like, I'm happy to have the opportunity to get to go make this motion that, you know, as part of, you know, destroying, you know, the Old Republic.
Yeah. Well, while we're doing psychological profiles, another character that comes to mind is Jabba the Hutt. Let's hear you wax eloquent about Jabba the Hutt.
Well, Jabba the Hutt is, big fat gang boss.
He's like a big slug or snail or something.
He is, very full. He's meant to be disgusting. Yeah. You know, he is the fat cat, except for not being a cat in a little way. You know, he is, of course, you see his whole species. You get, they're all shaped like that. You know, and it's very family quality with them, too. But he is cruel. He's sadistic, actually. You know, it's like, why keep Han Solo as a trophy? If he doesn't want Han Solo around, eliminate him would be a practical thing. It's like, no, he's keeping him around as a trophy. Why put Princess Leia in her slave Leia outfit and a chain, which she uses to kill him?
Yeah.
But why is he doing that in the first place? You know, there's a sexism to it and a cruelty. You know, he is in many ways one of the cruelest characters in the entire series, and he has fun with it. He laughs about these things. You know, Palpatine, the Emperor, has a lot of cruelty to him, but he doesn't seem as amused by it as Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt has a big old sense of humor. It's just usually at the expense of someone else's dignity or even life.
I'm just realizing that he's kind of the archetypal mafia boss. you know?
Oh, yes. He probably makes a lot of offers people can't refuse.
Yeah, right.
Many dead horse creatures' heads have been left.
Okay. Well, as we wind down, I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to add that we haven't touched on here.
Oh, there are too many things. You know, Star Wars is a very rich story, so fascinating with these characters. I am just really glad that we finally get the next episode. It's not what George Lucas had in mind way back when, but you know, the prequels have shown us we don't necessarily want what George Lucas had in mind. If it has more to do with how he told the story more than anything else. You know, he's not telling it the same way he did with the original trilogy. I am very excited. I've been looking forward, you know, to there being the next chapter since 1983. And I'm excited that it's going to happen. And I love seeing that it stretches across generations. My 10-year-old nephew at Thanksgiving spent an hour and a half when he talked about Star Wars with me.
Great. That,
his excitement is exciting to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great. I think you probably will have ignited some excitement in our listeners. And so, Dr. Travis Langley, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me here. I've enjoyed this.
You might notice that this interview is about half as long as my usual ones. This was because, evidently, the topic is so popular now, what with the new Star Wars movie coming out, that Dr. Langley could only spare a half hour. In fact, he had another interview scheduled immediately after ours. As you heard me mention, I used to teach a class at Sonoma State University titled Myth, Dream, and Symbol, and one of the required books was Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces. In it, he notes that there is this one great universal story, which is the journey of the hero. And the story takes different guises and different times and cultures, but the broad outlines contain certain key elements. Typically, the story starts off with what Campbell describes as the call to adventure, in which the hero, who at the beginning is a person who would seem to be a most unlikely candidate for a heroic role, the call is often delivered by a herald who may be ugly, loathsome, terrifying, or a beast. Campbell says the call symbolically signifies destiny has called the hero for some kind of death and rebirth. Often there is a protective figure who may be the herald or another figure, maybe a little old crone or a wise man. Think of Yoda from Star Wars. Campbell says this figure represents the benign, protecting power of destiny. In speaking of the departure, Campbell underscores what he calls the crossing of the first threshold. The purpose, he says, is to warn off those not ready for the journey. The threshold guardian must be passed by if the adventure is to continue. Another motif is the belly of the whale, the worldwide womb image of being swallowed by a whale. Think Jonah, Pinocchio. The journey is down into the darkness. It represents a kind of death and rebirth. According to Campbell, it symbolizes a kind of self-annihilation in which the hero goes inward to be born again. And then comes the road of trials, a major stage of the adventure. After passing the threshold, the hero must pass a succession of trials. Think of all the fairy tales in which there are marvelous tests that the hero must undergo. Think Don Quixote, or in more modern times, think of Jack Kerouac, where the title of the book is On the Road. So there is a world literature of miraculous tests and ordeals, and often the hero is aided by advice or amulets or helpers or supported by unseen powers, as think of the Force in Star Wars. So symbolically, it's a journey into the unconscious. And so it goes on to other stages that I won't go into here. That's as far as I'll take you here, but you might want to read or reread part one of Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And as always, you can order any of Dr. Travis Langley's four books by going to the right-hand sidebar on our site
and using our Amazon.com widget there. And by doing so, you'll be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
This is your conscience calling. This is your conscience calling. It's time to give. Time to give to Dr. Dave and his wonderful, wonderful, intriguing, psychological podcast network. Please give. You'll feel much, much better for it. Just click on the donate button and give what you can to Shrink Wrap Radio. You know you'll feel better. You know it makes sense. So let's all keep the network alive.
Thank you, Phil Schneider, for that very dramatic appeal. And given that we are now in the season of holiday giving, it's particularly timely. So do listen to your conscience and help support our efforts here. In fact, Paul Krause is someone who gives to Shrink Wrap Radio, and he sent me an article from the Greater Good Center in Berkeley, California, on 5 research-supported ways that giving is good for you. I won't go through the research here, but they say it supports that, 1, giving makes us feel happy, 2, giving is good for our health, 3, giving promotes cooperation and social connection, 4, giving evokes gratitude, and 5, giving is contagious. I'm happy to report that we do have 2 new donors on our honor roll since the last episode. My sincere thanks goes out to Robert Forsyth and Bob Dela. The Zur Institute has redone a bunch of transcripts for the CE course on meditation that we offer through them. Evidently, the volunteer transcripts weren't accurate enough to meet their requirements, so there are new transcripts for the following episodes. Number 137, Buddhist Happiness with Sylvia Boorstein. Number 139, Conscious Living and Dying with Anna Marie Hemingway. Number 152, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction with Elisha Goldstein. Number 221, Secrets of the Bulletproof Spirit with Azim Kamisa. Number 251, Mindfulness and Psychotherapy with Patrick Thornton. Number 264, Beyond Forgiveness, Reflections on Atonement with Phil Cousineau. Number 275, Understanding Laughter as Medicine with Madan Kataria, MD. Number 288, The Buddha Occupies Wall Street with Shokin Michael Stone. And number 306, The Now Effect with Elisha Goldstein. This is an excellent lineup of interviews, which now includes an excellent set of transcripts when you sign up for the course titled Meditation and Psychotherapy for 8 Continuing Education Units. And you can get a 10% discount off the cost of that course using the discount code DRDAVE88, that's DRDAVE88. And that discount code will work on any of Zur's courses and private practice materials, whether by me or not. Just go to www.zur.com/catalog.
Yeah, so tell me what happened.
You know, the pain that we were talking about with his arm and his neck, the shooting pain, you know, was an everyday occurrence. And he, you know, Mike sent 3 sample bottles. And he took the first bottle, he took the first 2 caplets in the morning, like you told me, and he started seeing a little decrease in the pain, but not much. When he took the next 2 caplets that night, I would say probably after an hour, he saw a 50% decrease in the pain. And then by the next morning when he woke up, he didn't even have any neck pain. He saw a huge difference. Mm. And then over the next day or two, he didn't have any pain at all.
Oh, wow. So that's a big change.
It was amazing. So he went from literally having to use ice packs and the heating pad back and forth to he's been coming home and not having to use it at all.
How long has he had the pain?
He's had the pain for probably the last 8 weeks, and he went to an orthopedic doctor, had 2 steroid shots, went to 2 chiropractors. So, I mean, this is unbelievable. So, I couldn't believe it.
Now, what you just heard was yet another snippet of a recording between Dr. Hedaya and a satisfied customer who purchased his herbal pain product, Unflame. I myself, as I've mentioned before, am a satisfied user of Unflame, and you can be too by clicking on our ad in the right-hand sidebar on the website or by calling direct at 1-619-500-4372. Use discount code CREEDRV, all caps, for $5 off per bottle. Finally, we have a relatively new sponsor for the show. Warby Parker thinks glasses should not cost as much as an iPhone. I certainly agree with that sentiment because the last time I got glasses, I needed a pair for driving, a pair for reading, a pair for working at the computer, and a pair of prescription sunglasses. I can tell you that adds up. With Warby Parker, you'll typically pay $95, including frames and prescription lenses. Interestingly, 2 of my sons were already Warby Parker customers before I started advertising them here. In fact, it was my son's enthusiastic reports that made me want to have Warby Parker as a sponsor. I fully expect that I will be one of their customers the next time I need glasses. Part of their appeal is that you can try on frames in the comfort of your own home. Warby Parker is an online service that will send you 5 frames that you've selected from their website. You'll be able to try out those frames at home for as long as you like, get feedback from family and friends, and once you've made your selection, you send the frames back to Warby Parker in the convenient prepaid packaging they've supplied, along with your prescription. Their prescription glasses start at $95, including the frame and prescription lenses. To place your order or get more information, use our affiliate link, which is www.warbyparkertrial.com/shrink. One last thing. I noticed that 195 countries have agreed that climate change is, in fact, a problem and have pledged to pitch in to address the problem. The number 195 stands out to me because that's also the number of countries in which there are shrink wrap radio listeners. Maybe we're having more of an impact than I realized.
Hi, my name is David Bradley. Come on over, have a seat. We'll make room. We're all friends here. All comfortable? All right. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, David Bradley. Hey, folks, I could use some more of these transitions. How about sending me a brief audio file along the lines of this is so-and-so and in such-and-such a place, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Or you can exercise a bit of creativity like David Bradley just did. Today, I'll read several emails from our listener community. The first one is from Boston Jungian analyst Michelle Seligson, in which she comments on my last column in our newsletter, in which I confess to not being a big fan of the Myers-Briggs type inventory. Michelle writes, "My sentiments exactly. The MBTI did Jung a disservice big time, as it codified a fluid conceptual framework and then monetized it. With very best wishes, Dr. Dave." And that's from Michelle Seligson in Boston. Well, Michelle, thanks so much for letting me know that I'm not alone out there in my radical opinion, and also for reading our monthly newsletter. It's great to know that it's actually being read. Next, we hear from Mayar in Iran, who writes in response to my interview with Shannon Love about her 3 experiences with psychosis. And Mayar writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for the last interviews, specifically your very impressive interview with Shannon Love. I sent her an email informing her of my awe and admiration for her book and what she's aimed to do. Though I've just read the first and part of the second chapters available online on Amazon, I came to believe that her memoir would be a great read, and I've asked a friend to see if she could bring me a copy on her way to Iran. I don't know much about the U.S., but such conditions are highly stigmatized here in Iran, although I wouldn't be surprised to hear if the same goes there as well on the average. Given all that, I still believe she's done something brave, and it can teach us, me in particular, many things. I hope someday someone would narrate his or her story of a psychotic break here in Iran. I've also asked my friend to see if she can get me a copy of I'm Working on It in Therapy. I heard the interview and thought maybe it would be helpful for us in Iran. Again, not many therapy clients here have any idea of what therapy means and how it can help them. I'm sorry I didn't write to you sooner. Besides my day-to-day chores, I was in shock about what happened in Paris, and I don't know why, but I prefer to keep my writing short in that period. Many thanks again for all you've done. Always yours, Mayar. Well, Mayar, unfortunately, there still is a stigma attached to psychosis in this country as well, although I can imagine it might be even worse in Iran. I wish it were easier for you to obtain the books you want there in Iran, and I can easily understand that the terrorist attack in Paris made you feel less chatty and more reflective. It was a sad day for the planet. Finally, we hear from Robert in Australia, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I really enjoy listening to your shows. I'm a health professional, but not a psychologist, and I find your wide variety of subject matter very stimulating. Your show has introduced me to many new concepts. There was just one aspect of the show with Dr. Julie Gottman that concerned me. Dr. Gottman said when she was talking about what she did before therapy that domestic abuse is thought to be less damaging to men. My initial reaction to this statement was shock, as I am a survivor of domestic abuse perpetrated by a female, and it certainly felt damaging to me. However, once my emotion had settled, I became curious and would like to know if there's any empirical evidence to back up this statement by Dr. Gottman. If there's not, I would very much appreciate it if this could be corrected on the show. While I understand that violence against females is more prevalent in many cultures, I'm always concerned that domestic abuse against males is minimized, which has the capacity to further victimize people who are already victims. Many thanks for your consideration. And that's from Robert in Australia. You know, Robert, that remark of Dr. Gottman slipped right by me during the interview. Frankly, I don't know if there is empirical evidence to back up her statement. I think with a little time on the internet, you might be able to investigate the question. Certainly, there is little question that female battering of males happens, and the victims struggle with a lot of shame, among other effects. I really appreciate your sharing here. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Travis Langley, for his insights into the dark side of the Star Wars films. My next guest will be Sandeep Vaishnavi, MD, on the traumatized brain. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've got the key to the highway, feet up and ready to go. Oh, I'm listening to Dr. Dave, that old shrink wrap radio. Now when the moon peep on the mountain, I'll be on my way, listening to that quiet little voice, I walk along life's old highway. I've got the key to the highway. Got myself feet up and I've got to grow. Oh, taking to the air now. Walking's most too slow. So come with me now, people. Let's go explore the great unknown. We got the key to that inner highway. That's where we're meant to roam. So open up your hearts now, people. It's the only way to grow. Love is the key to that highway. You heard it on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.